My name is Mary Geisman. I'm co-chair of the Peace and Justice Task Force here at All Souls. On behalf of All Souls and the Peace and Justice Task Force, I welcome all of you here to this very important program to hear people who have just returned from Afghanistan. We are delighted to have our panel here tonight. I'd like to recognize a couple of people before we start. Way in the back is Linda Russo, who's my co-chair of the Peace and Justice Task Force. And Joan Weil, who's the founder of Grandmothers Against the War, who's responsible for this program. There's a description of the Peace and Justice Task Force and what we try to do on the back of your program for tonight, and I hope you'll look at that. On that, there's a list of upcoming events, and I would like to particularly draw your attention to the next week, where on Tuesday we are hosting the annual Metro New York Religious Campaign Against Torture interfaith service and program to mark the 9th anniversary of the first prisoner's arrival at Guantanamo. So that will be downstairs here at the church, and I hope as many of you as possible will attend that. Then next Sunday, a week from Sundays, on the 16th, we will host Say Yes, Voices of Unity, which is building bridges between Muslims, Christians, and Jews through music. It's a wonderful concert. This is the third year we're doing it. It will be here in the sanctuary at 5 o'clock on the 16th. There's flyers on the tables in the back, and I hope all of you will come to that. One other thing before we get started, well, a couple of things. Usual announcement from up here is turn off your cell phones if you have them. And secondly, you'll notice there's a number of cameras around. This is being filmed. We have some press here. If you don't want to be on camera, don't go to the microphone and ask a question. Now, it's my great pleasure to introduce our moderator for the evening, Viney Burroughs. Viney describes herself as an actor, storyteller, and activist, and she certainly is all of those.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mary Geisman, and we also want to thank the organizers for this very important, and you will find it to be a most illuminating and informative session. I am grateful to Joan Weil, who, when she called me on Wednesday to say, would I moderate? And I asked her, please send me some background material. She did, and my eyes were open, and my heart was overwhelmed. I read what one 14-year-old Afghani boy wrote. Why did you kill my father? You didn't even know him. How much does it cost to make a gun? Why don't you make bread instead? Why do the people of Russia, Pakistan, Iran, the United States keep saying, we are right? What do you wish for? Aren't we all human beings? Love. We wish love, forgiveness, peace. We wish for humanity. What can we do now? We'll all die one day. What can we do now? And I think that is a plea from an Afghani child to us. And now we're going to have, opening our program, Eric Stoner, who is a New York-based freelance journalist and an adjunct professor at St. Peter's College, where I once taught for a semester. He has written for The Guardian, Mother Jones, and The Nation. He blogs at Waging Nonviolence, and he's on the national board of the War Resisters League. Let's please welcome Eric Stoner.
Thank you. Well, thank you all for coming out tonight, especially in the snow. I appreciate it. It's a pleasure to be here with you all tonight. We're here to talk about our recent trip to Afghanistan, which we both just returned from within the last week. So it's still very fresh in my mind, this experience. It was my first trip to a war zone. So I still feel like I have a lot to process from this experience, but would like to offer a few reflections and observations from my time there. Afghanistan has really fallen off the radar of the mainstream media over the last year or two. And I think it's fallen out of most Americans' minds as well these days. President Obama recently declared that we are on track to meet our goals and that significant progress is being made, he said. But that was far from the ground reality that we experienced being there this last month. The truth is that there's more violence and death right now, today, in Afghanistan than at any point since we invaded in 2001. More soldiers, both US and NATO, more Afghan soldiers and police, more humanitarian workers, and more civilians were all killed last year than any year to date. One tally that just came out put the total war dead at over 10,000 just for 2010. And as you all know, there's no end in sight. The tentative withdrawal date keeps being pushed further and further into the future. Amazingly, even the military officials now are saying that it's likely only to get worse in this coming year. While we often focus in the peace movement on how many people have been killed, trying to grasp those numbers, either soldiers or civilians, to gauge the cost of the war, being in Afghanistan made me realize that that's actually can be a limiting way of trying to really understand the human toll of the conflict. War has impacted Afghan society and its people in so many other ways, many of which are far more widespread and devastating than just trying to do the agonizing count of how many people have lost their lives from the direct violence. So I'd like to share just a few of these more overlooked aspects of the war that I was made aware of during this trip. The first thing that really struck me, and I think probably strikes anyone when they go to Kabul, is the quality of the air. It has a really distinctive smell. It's a unique mix of dust and smog and burning wood or trash. And there's literally a dust cloud that engulfs the city all the time. When you drive around, it's literally like you're constantly in fog or a haze that just never disappears. Last month, the Afghan government actually came out and announced that 3,000 people die in the city alone from every year from the pollution, which makes it a far bigger killer than the Taliban. But how many of us have ever heard that or think about that when we think of Afghanistan? I was told by one Afghan expat that it wasn't always that way. That before the civil war broke out in the early 90s, when parts of the city were completely leveled by different warlords that the U.S. had supported and armed before, during, and after the Soviet occupation, that the city was actually clean and green and that there were parks and trees, which is really hard to believe when you see the state of disrepair that the city has fallen into over the last decade. And it's really, the whole city is just a shade, like a monotonous shade of brown. There's very little color, which is difficult. After 10 years and they say close to $20 billion in reconstruction aid for the country, it's very difficult to see where the money has gone. Many roads are still not paved, which contributes to the pollution because cars are then kicking up all this dust into the air. Electricity still regularly goes out, sometimes for hours at a time. And that means that there are literally something like several hundred thousand diesel-powered generators that are humming every day to keep the electricity on, which adds to the pollution. And you still don't have a sewer system for a city that has now a population of more than 5 million people. So driving around, seeing piles of old, rotting trash on the side of the road is a very regular occurrence. And taking all this in really reminded me that war destroys not only people, but it actually poisons the earth, and it poisons the air that we breathe and the water that we drink as well. While money never materialized, like I said, to rebuild the infrastructure of Kabul that has been overwhelmed by returning refugees from Pakistan since the U.S. invasion and from a new flood of refugees caused by the U.S. invasion, money was found to basically turn the city into an open-air prison. There are men on virtually every block with AK-47s. I've never seen anything like this before. There are concrete blast walls and sandbags and razor wire everywhere. We were regularly patted down and frisked wherever we went for weapons. So it really was a feeling like you were almost in a prison, that this whole city had been turned into a prison. And you know, despite all these efforts to create security, you still got the sense that the Taliban could strike whenever they wanted, and that the security that we sensed was really just an illusion. Unfortunately, we saw how true this was while we were there, when there was a suicide attack in Kabul that killed 5 Afghan army officers in the worst attack in the city since May. So you did get the sense that it was very, very tentative, very superficial, this veneer of security. Afghanistan is also plagued by poverty and unemployment. It consistently ranks as one of the least developed countries in the world, according to the UN Human Development Index. And as a Westerner, you really can't walk more than a block or two on the streets in Kabul without being approached by desperate street children begging for change. So it made any trip out very painful to see these children. While most of them are selling packs of gum or Kleenex, one young boy had a clever approach given everyone's concerns about security. He came up and said, I'll be your bodyguard for a price, of course. And while it was kind of funny, I also realized that this is kind of the dark humor that comes along with war, that this is what this maybe 10-year-old kid had to say. It's really terrible to think that in some ways these kids are actually the lucky ones. Decades of war and lack of funding for basic social services, including healthcare, have left the country in a state of perpetual crisis. Afghanistan has the worst infant mortality rates in the world. There's 1 in 4 Afghan children won't live to see their 5th birthday, which is hard to believe. And it actually has the lowest life expectancy in the world at 44 years. It's hard to fathom the lost potential in that statistic of what the country could be if people were able to live full lives. The only countries that are even comparable when you look at the numbers are those in Africa that are like Zimbabwe or Zambia that are being ravaged by AIDS. But in Afghanistan, there's no disease that you can pin these miserable health statistics on, unless you consider violence and greed and indifference forms of sicknesses. Being there also made me consider what living through 30 years of continuous war does to the psyche of a people. Much as U.S. soldiers are afflicted by post-traumatic stress disorder, decades of war, I think, have traumatized the entire population. In the fall, Afghanistan's public health minister warned that more than 60% of the country's 30 million citizens currently suffer from stress disorders or from other mental health problems. And that's not surprising. Even being there just for 3 weeks, I could feel it taking a toll on me, these constantly thinking and worrying about safety and security and realizing that I had it much better than most people in Afghanistan. We also had the good fortune of spending more than 2 weeks with the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers, which is an amazing group of young people calling for peace and nonviolence and an immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops. They also oppose the Taliban and the warlords, which is a very dangerous and courageous position to take in the country. Hakim is the group's mentor, and he is actually a medical doctor from Singapore, who's been living in the country for the last 6 years and is really one of the most incredible peacemakers that I have ever met. In conversation, he told me of one other psychological cost that he's observed having lived there. He said that the war has created a situation where there is extreme distrust throughout the country, that nobody can believe that anybody could be acting on good intentions or acting altruistically, that there always has to be some ulterior motive, money or power or something. But they've lost the belief, I think, that people can just be good. And that the continuous war has really broken down bonds between people, which makes working for peace very hard because everyone is suspicious of this group, that there must be something else at play. There must be some other motive. In talking to some of these inspirational youngsters that are part of this group, over lunch one day, they also told me that some of them at times feel hopeless about the future, which really broke my heart. To hear a 15-year-old kid or a 13-year-old kid say that they don't have any hope is something you should never have to hear. But this loss of trust and loss of hope in the future are hidden costs of the war that we don't ever think of and we can't measure. The ongoing U.S. offensive right now in the South and in the East has also led to a surge in the number of internally displaced people throughout the country. According to the UN, there are now at least 319,000 internally displaced people in Afghanistan. And 120,000 of those have fled over the last year and a half from the recent violence and the U.S. campaigns in the South. We visited Charahi Khambar, which is the largest of maybe 30 of these camps that are around Kabul. And it made me realize how inadequate and bureaucratic that term, internally displaced people, is, how much suffering and pain it masks. I still feel like I am at a loss of words to really describe how bad it was. Several thousand families live in this camp that we visited, and most had fled from Sangin or from Marja or other parts of Helmand province where the U.S. military is currently on attack. And I was absolutely horrified by the conditions that these people were forced to live in. They occupy these simple mud huts and have only tarps for roofs. Apart from having blankets or burning wood or trash in the evening, there's nothing to keep the cold, the bitter cold of Kabul's winters out, which regularly kills the most vulnerable people in these camps, especially the children. So some of the people we talked to had lost children or were worried about their children passing this current winter, which is just starting there. There is no adequate access to food, to clean water, to education for the kids, to work for the adults. There's no electricity. They really have nothing. It's a situation of utter desperation, something that I've never seen anything even close to it. One Afghan man who was talking to us at the camp asked, "Do you think that this is a human way to live?" And I didn't have an answer, and I don't think he was expecting an answer. After showing us pictures, these old faded black and white pictures of his children who had been killed during a U.S. bombing, this same man took us deep into the camp to meet a couple other relatives of his who had been injured in that same attack. We entered this mud hut and were introduced to this beautiful 9-year-old girl who was his niece, and she was covered in dirt, as all the children we saw were there. Many of them looked like they hadn't bathed in weeks. And she had very scraggly hair, but she was still very beautiful. And this man ended up unzipping her jacket a little and pulling down the jacket to show that she had lost her arm at the shoulder from a U.S. bomb. And it was probably the saddest thing that I've ever seen, and really made me want to cry and just give them everything that I had. But I was distinctly aware at the same time that this was not a unique story, that everyone in this camp, by virtue of living there, had similar tragic stories of suffering and loss. While I was a pacifist before going on this trip, breathing in the wretched air of Kabul, seeing the poverty firsthand and the lack of infrastructure and social services, and spending some time with these innocent people who have borne the brunt of the violence and the war, has convinced me more than ever, more than any book or movie ever could, that no matter what our intentions are in Afghanistan, that war and violence are not the solution to our concern for security or to the many crises that Afghans face. Everyday people like these people in the refugee camps that we met are the inevitable victims of war, and they always will be. And the problems that they face cannot be solved by the military. To create true security, people need food. They need water, they need medicines, they need schools, they need jobs. They don't need more bombs and bullets. And as the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteer wrote in a recent statement calling for the U.S. exit, they say, "Again and again here in Afghanistan, we have seen a hope for nonviolence light up. Every day we see a yearning for humane relationships. And because of this, love is how we now firmly take our stand. But we do ask, plead, and demand that you stop your unsustainable superpower militarism. We want peace. We want you out. I think we would do well to listen to these wise young Afghan peacemakers. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric Stoner, for giving us something about the grim reality of the life of the people in Afghanistan. I was particularly struck by the refugee camp outside of Kabul. No water, no electricity, no kitchen, mud walls on four sides, plastic for a roof, ground underneath. And why? You said something about war. War is the violence. War is the sickness. And as that young boy asked us in the beginning, and I read it, what are we going to do now? I believe, and we didn't talk about this, whether we will have the question and answer after hearing all the speakers.
So
then now we can welcome Kathy Stoner.
Kathy Keller.
We can read about Kathy Keller, but I was struck by the fact that you've been jailed more than 60 times in this country and abroad. She has been to Iraq, at least 3 or 4 times with both wars and in combat zone. Kathy Keller is also very concerned about the condition of prisoners in our country, as she's concerned also about those who are in prison in other places. Thank you very much, and let us welcome Kathy Keller.
Thank you. Well, good evening to all of you. It's a privilege to be here with this group. I know that some of you, organized by Joan, have every week for a long time been outdoors and vigiling and trying to protest these wars. And maybe sometimes people look at you as hopeless idealists, but you're the dazzling realists. I got that from Albert Camus. You're the dazzling realists, and we must walk in the light of that realism. That's where we would find security in our homeland, amongst those people who want to feel the sorrow of war and remind us about exactly that sorrow. And maybe for my part, I can offer a kind of a confessional parable to you. I graduated from Loyola University at the time when you could walk away from university studies with your overdue library fine. But the hitch was you had to work your summer job and your part-time and weekend job. And so my summer job was at Rose Packing Company. And I remember it very vividly. You know, you'd walk into the factory floor and be given combat boots and a white smock that didn't stay white very long and a yellow rubber apron and goggles and gloves and a big T-hook, a stainless steel hook. And I was to stand on top of an overturned milk crate in front of a vat full of frozen pork loins and start slinging. And, you know, after the first hour, I'd have gone through every memorized prayer I ever knew. And the second hour, I'd done just about any Broadway tune I'd ever heard. By the third hour, I'd be thinking, I hope those Jesuits have some mighty good courses lined up, slinging pork loins all day long. Sometimes I'd get the easier job of just pressing on a pedal and squirting the waste material from the factory floor into plastic tubing, and that's how they made hot dogs. And I did become a vegetarian. I went back a second summer to work at this job, slinging pork loins in the meatpacking factory. But the reason I tell you this story is because it wasn't until January of last year I had something like an epiphany. And I realized that if anyone had ever said to me in the ensuing years, from the time I worked at the meatpacking factory till January of last year, "Kathy Kelly, you slaughtered animals," I know I would have said, "Oh, there are a lot of Kathy Kellys. You've got the wrong one. I never killed an animal in my life. I'm a city girl." Of course, I was very involved. For 8 cents an hour extra than I would have gotten working at the shoe store or Continental Bank, I was very involved in a Chicago slaughterhouse. I was part of the process. It took me 40 years to acknowledge that. And of course, the reason I think that's come up from my subconscious, the reason it's on my mind so much, is that we're now involved in the 10th year of a war, which has by and large been forgotten by the US public, even though it's still going on. Denial, distance, an almost utter lack of sorrow. How shall we seek forgiveness when we don't even feel the sorrow? The sorrow over what Eric has just told us. The sorrow, the remorse, the regret, the chagrin, and the slaughter of human beings who've meant us no harm goes on. And so we were so privileged to meet with the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers, with youngsters who, when they heard that Colonel Ann Wright from the U.S. Army, a retired U.S. diplomat, and Mike Ferner, the national president of Veterans for Peace, and Eric Stoner, who is a young peace activist who has his own blog on waging nonviolence, and these other voices for creative nonviolence characters were coming, they decided that they were going to make the best of that time that we had together. I was exhausted. These youngsters, when I'd gone previously, had taken us to their town in Bamyan, one of the most beautiful places in the world, and they had introduced us to their families, and we sat in villages, and it was an entrancing time. And Kabul is not exactly a charming place. It's bedraggled, and it's a city that's been war-torn and beaten down. But these youngsters decided that they would do project after project, trying to use our time together as best they could. And so they decided that even though they could see that the December review that the Obama administration had mandated was going to be a cover-up, a smokescreen, if you will. Even the generals were saying, well, there's not going to be any policy change. This will just be a diagnostic. It's almost as though, you know, you diagnose the problem, maybe, but you already know that you're not going to try to approach a solution. You're just going to keep what's been going on, and has not even, according to Obama's own intelligence agencies, two intelligence agencies, concluded that there is no success in terms of a military campaign against the Taliban. And yet President Obama went before the U.S. public to reassure a vastly sleeping public that success is happening, that significant progress is being made. And never at any point was there any mention in the Obama December review of any of the conditions that entrap these youngsters and affect their daily life. We're talking about a country where 850 children die every single day. And the United States is spending $1 million per soldier per year. A district governor in Afghanistan earns $70 a month. And presumably the district governor speaks the language, has some grip on some of the problems, has some awareness of where things might go if they were to head in a better direction. But we spend $1 million to keep one United States soldier in Afghanistan for a year, and every morning 7,000 trucks set forth. Pakistanis and Afghans take their lives in their hands to drive those trucks and bring supplies, bring food, bring water, potable water, bring materials to the United States troops who are so comparatively, comfortably situated. And the situation of the Charahi Kambar camp that Eric described was one which is immediately across the road from one of these camps, where there's a mile and a half fencing that's made of the best kind of material, and on the other side of that fence you have an ammunition set up and you have a camp set up where the United States troops are relatively very, very well cared for. Well, the Afghan youth peace volunteers, when they're not with people like us in Kabul, live a very demanding life in Bamyan. Abdul Ali gets up at 2 o'clock in the morning to get on his donkey and ride for 6 hours to a mountainside where he can collect twigs and scrub brush and load it on the donkey and bring it back home so that there will be some source of fuel for his family for the day and for the continuing harsh winter. And Abdullahi, 6 o'clock every morning, will be out collecting water again on the donkey and bringing it back for distribution to his family and other families in the village. And these youngsters have begun to learn English quite well. You know, I've certainly had my time of it trying to learn a foreign language, and it's not easy. And they want to study, but they only get 2 hours of electricity per day, often after midnight. And so they can't stay up at night and study very effectively. And the only food available through these harsh winter months in their village is bread and potatoes. And so you get the harsh and the horrible statistics, 850 children dying every single day from malnourishment, from gastrointestinal diseases, from curable diseases like respiratory infections. Hunger and anger. A Pakistani journalist wrote that they're like two live wires, and when they touch, hunger and anger, you can expect an incandescent flash, and maybe it's not controllable. And I did have some experience of that intense anger. A youngster at the Bamyan University said to me, "Do Americans care more about noses than fingers?" And this was in October of this year, in a previous trip that I'd taken to Afghanistan. And I looked kind of blankly. I didn't know what he was talking about. And I checked to see if my companions were in any better shape, and they didn't know either. And then I got back to Mary House Catholic Worker, and I was reading the New York Times, and all of a sudden it dawned on me what he meant. You see, he had held up a picture of the young woman whose nose was mutilated, that ghastly situation of a young woman who was in a family where the men punished her by mutilating her face. And that was a hideous thing to do. No one would argue that. But what most Americans didn't know was that a striker brigade based in Washington State was going up before a trial because they had gone on a 3-month killing spree. And the staff sergeant in this brigade was accused, even by others within his platoon, of being somebody who would encourage ways to get around the rules of war, the rule of law amongst the military, that he knew ways to kill civilians and you wouldn't necessarily get caught. And he not only did that, he cut off the fingers of his victims and he saved them as war trophies. And that's why the university student had asked me with white hot anger, "Do Americans care more about noses than fingers?" It's a crude question. Hunger and anger combined. And I was in a situation where a survivor of a drone bombing asked me, "Do people in your country know? Are they aware of these drones that fly overhead and aim hellfire missiles at our villages and send bodies across vast distances until they break?" And I said, "Well, yes, people are beginning to realize on the university campuses." And he said, no, he was a journalist. He said, "What I mean is, do average, ordinary people know?" And I said, "Well, actually, no, most people aren't aware." And then he asked me, "Where is your democracy?" And then his friend said to me, "It's a real problem here, the hatred that people in our land are beginning to feel toward Americans. It's a real problem, and they were concerned for us, for our security." the realities that people are facing, I think it's helpful at times as we try to get a grip on why does this war continue, to take a look at the maps, and Jessel so kindly offered to help me on the screen there. There are several maps, and the first one is kind of greenish, am I right? Okay. There are 33 provinces in Afghanistan today, which, according to statistics, have shadow governance that is controlled by the Taliban. So when we are told that significant progress is being made, we have to also take a look at the fact that the Taliban have not had a problem recruiting more people. In fact, it's been said time and time again that the night raids, the death squads, the assassinations, the drone bombings create, quote, terrorists faster than you can kill them. More people come to join these Taliban groups. And the United States is now spending $800 per gallon of fuel going into Afghanistan. It was $400 back in October, but then I read the statistic that it's $800. Now, how could that be? Well, the planes drop down in Karachi, which you can see on the southern coast of Pakistan on the map. But then drivers, these 7,000 drivers I mentioned, have to bring the supplies up along the Durand line, go inside of Pakistan, and go along roads that are controlled by the warlords, controlled by the Taliban quite often. And the United States is paying thousands of dollars per truck to bring these resources to the U.S. bases. So your tax dollars are being used to pay the very Taliban that we're fighting against. And that's part of why it costs $1 million per soldier per year. Jessel, if you could just go on to the next map. It's about, and what you'll see is a map that has on the, let's see, the right-hand side, the real map of borders. And you'll note that there's a border that's shared between Pakistan and Iran. You'll note that in the real map, Pakistan has a border with China. But a CIA analyst named Ralph Peters designed this map, which I'd happened to see in the New York Times, and I noticed when I was in Pakistan that almost every affluent, well-educated, English-speaking person I met with was familiar with this map. They know about this map, and this is a think tank's dream of what might become in the future of greater support for the United States national interest. Not my interest, I don't think your interest, but the idea would be an independent Baluchistan would cut away from Pakistan. There would be a revolt, a rebellion, and actually there have been many suggestions of revolution within Baluchistan, but the advantage to the United States would be that then you'd cut off the border between Pakistan and Iran. And you'd further fragment the one Muslim country that possesses the nuclear bomb. And then notice that in this imaginary map, Afghanistan sort of arcs over Pakistan on the opposite map, the one that's being imagined, so that the border between China and Pakistan is also cut off. And people that we spoke with said, yes, we think this is what the United States may be trying to accomplish. Geopolitically, if the United States can have bases all over Afghanistan and networks connecting those 400 bases that already exist now, just speaking of U.S. bases, then there's the possibility that the United States can squeeze Iran, squeeze Russia, and if, in fact, we are in a Cold War with China, nobody wants to say it because we're so economically interdependent with China, but the United States in Central Asia can control the resources if it's got a huge military presence, resources that China, that close neighbor, would presumably want to have access to. So if we look at the next map, it's sometimes called Pipelinistan. And do you see the Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India pipeline, the TAPI, and this was the centerpiece of the NATO gathering in Lisbon when the NATO leaders were cheering, saying, now we have a purpose, now we can continue. The Asia Development Bank has approved the TAPI pipeline. It's going to start in 2014, and when are the generals telling us now that the troops will possibly begin to go? Oh, 2014. And meanwhile, that peace pipeline coming from Iran, going through Pakistan to India, is still in the books. That's another possibility. But when we ask ourselves, why is the United States persisting in Afghanistan? I don't think it's truthful to say that the United States cares about the mothers who carry their bundles to the cemetery, 850 mothers every day. I don't think it's truthful to say that the United States cares about the Afghan youth peace volunteers who work so hard every day to be contributing members of their family and who want to be part of an alternative December review. Not a single United States media group paid attention to the press conference that these young boys had organized. But we were lucky to pay attention to them and to the several projects that Mike Ferner wrote about so effectively. And so I want to close by inviting all of us to feel in the deep heart's core the sorrow of this war, to let ourselves feel that sorrow so that we also will experience those two live wires of hunger and anger. It's okay to be angry about what our country has done. It's okay to be angry that our country is being perceived as a menacing and a fearsome force. But let us also feel hunger. Hunger for peace, hunger for justice, hunger for a change, so that we can be part of the tipping that will tip our world away from the cruelty, away from the futility of war after war, perpetual war. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy Kelly, for your impassioned remarks. I think that we are all fired up. And at the close of this evening's affair and this evening's discussion, I hope we will go forth with some concrete suggestions of what we can do to spread this message. And now for our next speaker, I am delighted to bring to the podium Mike Ferner, who is president of the National Veterans for Peace. He was also on the City Council of Toledo, Ohio, and ran for mayor with a very considerable, although you didn't win, you had a considerable
672 votes, but who's counting?
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much for the invitation to be here, and for those of you who worked so hard to put this together. I'm sure there are a lot of people here tonight who know that these kinds of programs don't just organize themselves, and it does take work, so thank you. I missed my flight from Kabul on Wednesday, which I was planning on taking so that I would get here yesterday. As it turns out, I was able to do some scrambling, and that with the help of a couple of very nice Aeroflot clerks, got rebooked and got here 24 hours after I was hoping to. So Bill and Georgia Gilson met me at Penn Station just before I got here, and that was the culmination of Kabul to Dubai to Moscow to JFK. So I'm going to be brief, and I figure if I stand up here and don't drool on myself, that would be a successful talk. So Eric did a very good job of describing some of the objective conditions, and Kathy, as usual, has the eloquence and the passion of any of our famous organizers in our past, and it's always a pleasure to be able to listen to her. What I wanted to say, just a couple of comments, a couple of observations. You know, Eric said that the conditions that he described were the worst that, you know, he'd never seen anything like it. And I took a trip to Central America with Veterans for Peace in 1987. And as you remember, that was when the Contra War against Nicaragua was going full steam, and the great Ronald Reagan was keeping that war going, and we were up to all sorts of mischief and evil in a couple of other countries in Central America. And one of the places that we visited was a refugee camp in Honduras, just over the Nicaragua border, where a lot of people had fled to get away from the Contra attacks. And obviously a different climate altogether than Kabul. It was a warm climate, so shelter wasn't quite as critical. But the conditions that I saw there were every bit as bad as the camp in Kabul that both of us visited. That was very much the same. I'm sure people that have been in Iraq after the U.S. invasion and the dislocations, to use a nice word, that occurred all through society have seen very similar conditions. I was at camps in and around Baghdad that were not even sponsored by any official aid agency or the UN. They just sprang up, and the conditions there, again, were every bit as bad as the ones that we saw in Kabul. And, you know, after a few times around the block, it starts to sink in that what we're seeing this time around is really, it's no different. I mean, it's terrible. It's inexcusable. It's painful to observe and to hear about, but it's nothing new. And one of the ways that I found it really helps me make sense of, and when I am speaking various places, seems to help people make sense of U.S. foreign policy. When they look at all this, really, in any sane person's view, all this crazy stuff that our government does and that we wind up paying for and that we keep doing over and over and over again, was Iraq a mistake? Well, no, I mean, to me, a mistake is when you make a left turn and you should have made a right turn. What we did in Iraq was a very calculated policy. And when you begin to look at the U.S. foreign policy over the years, it really, at least in my mind, it really helps make sense of it when you look at the fact that the United States is an empire and has been an empire for some time. And what do empires do? Well, they maintain the empire and they expand the empire. And those two things are what we see on an ongoing basis. That's why we're in Iraq and Afghanistan and in hundreds of places around the world, so that we can maintain an empire that the sun never sets on, and we know how long that one lasted. So it comes down to what can we do about this, and I know that the people here are concerned about that. Is anybody in the country and active? One of the things that I've been talking about with Veterans for Peace is to have us really consider the difference between activism and organizing. Activism, this is an act of activism tonight, putting this program together and inviting people and people that come to it. Those of you who have been involved in organizing know that there's really a difference. That organizing means going to other groups and finding out what their issues are and perhaps getting involved with them to whatever extent you can, and getting to know people that are involved in these other struggles and developing relationships with them. And the next thing you know, you have what it takes to really fuel a movement. And I don't believe that we can get that same energy just strictly from activism and doing the kinds of things that peace activists have done for so long. I mean, as noble and selfless as those things are, I don't think they lead to the kind of political power that we're going to need if we're going to really make a difference in the U.S. foreign policy and do something about this empire that is just rolling over people and crushing them from Central America to Kabul to Baghdad and on and on and on. One of the things that that I learned from the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers, both Eric and Kathy mentioned the 24-hour call-in telethon that the Voices for Creative Nonviolence and the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteer folks organized. And one of the things that that experience taught me was the importance of moral support. A lot of times in the past, I've thought, well, you know, nice words are great. But I saw the difference that it made to these young people, teenagers. The oldest guy there was 20. And when they got phone calls and emails from literally from around the world, and people recognized what they were doing and congratulated them on the courage and the work that they were doing, it made a difference. And I began to realize that not only was this an exercise in moral support that was very important to these young people, but that we were in a very real way beginning to form a support group for these young men in Bamiyan in case the very real possibility that who knows who, people in the Afghan government or warlords or whoever they've been speaking out against, decide that they've had quite enough from these guys. And people have been disappeared in many countries around the world for not any more than what these young men are doing. And how important it's going to be for them to be connected to a global community that stands ready to do the sorts of things that can be done to put pressure on governments far away to observe the human rights, even if they've already nabbed these guys off the street. And that was comforting. I mean, I hope that doesn't happen to them, but given the conditions there in Afghanistan and what Eric described about the difficulties of doing that kind of work, I can see how they could really get under the skin of powerful people pretty quickly. So that made it worth the trip. I didn't enjoy breathing what passes for air in Kabul any more than Eric or Kathy or anybody else did. It was really pretty awful. But just being able to be a part of that and see the work that these young men were doing was an inspiration to me. And I was happy to be able to be there. I've written a couple of pieces about it. They'll probably be on the Voices webpage, and they'll be much more articulate, I guarantee you, than I am here tonight. So I'd suggest going to the Voices website or the Veterans for Peace website if you want to find out more of the details on that. And I'd like to leave us with something that I find really appropriate, and whenever I start questioning whether sometimes the foreign policy of the U.S., if there might be something in there redeemable, and we start down the slippery slope of, well, maybe sometimes war is necessary. There's just, you know, it's always got to be the last option, but sometimes it's just necessary to have it on the table. And I've come to not believe in that anymore at all, because as long as it's the allowed to be the last option, it's always going to be used, sometimes way before we run out of other things. So that's why I'm really happy and proud to be a member of Veterans for Peace, one of our most dearly held purposes is to abolish war as an instrument of national policy. And I'm reminded of what Jeanette Rankin, a brave woman who voted against not just entry into World War I, but into entry into World War II as well, in the U.S. House from Montana. And she said, "You can no more win a war than you can win an earthquake." And if that doesn't sum up exactly what you get with a war, completely unintended consequences that are completely out of control. And the best thing we can do is to practice preventive medicine in the case of conflicts and not get into them in the first place. So I'm, again, very glad to have been invited to go to Afghanistan. It was an experience I'm very glad that I was able to participate in, and I want to thank the people who helped sponsor my trip. I sent emails to friends, and they responded, and just enough money came in to make the trip. So once again, the peace community came through. And it's a pleasure to be here with you tonight, and thanks for being here.
And thank you, Mike Ferner, for giving us that other side of the picture in terms of what we can do in terms of United States foreign policy. And now it becomes a chance for you, the audience, to give your questions or comments or observations to our speakers, to our panelists. I would ask you to come to the front, speak to the microphone, give your name and affiliation if you have one, and then ask your question. You can line up so that we want you to be brief, so that we'll have a chance to have many, many, many questions and then the answers. Thank you. Is it on? Can someone? Sir, can you?
Hello. Is that on?
No.
Hello.
Give it to him.
Now you hear me. Okay, so my name is Nancy Duplessis, and I thank you very much. I was able to participate in the call to the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers, which was a great experience. I think that it's really important when we're talking about organizing and getting people together.
Do you have a question that you want to, or this is the preliminary or the preamble to the question?
No, this is a comment. There were comments about the environment, the destruction of the environment, what we can do. And I think one of the really important things is to involve environmental groups, because war is destroying the environment, not just in Afghanistan, but many other places. And that I think is one resource that has really not been tapped. I also heard about something that was really hideous, but more of the same. This I heard in Germany, in Berlin, that a German group had discovered that near all these American bases, there were brothels for the American soldiers that were staffed by Korean and Vietnamese women, which is, you know, when you think about American wars and the comfort women, et cetera, I think we have to talk about all of these moral issues and the, you know, the that as part of the problem of war. Thank you.
Hi, Alan Stolzer. I'm a member of a group called Military Resistance. My question is to the three of you. Afghanistan is teeming with U.S. troops. While you were there, did you have any opportunity at all to interact with any U.S. troops?
I saw two patrols go by on the streets of Kabul, and these were the MRAPs, which I can never remember what they are, but the mine resistant something, or the Hummers, the Humvees on steroids that have been built up to try to withstand the IEDs. At any rate, there was two different patrols of those going by, and you don't have any opportunity to interact with them when they're driving by, because if you get near the patrol, you get shot. I mean, you have to stay back. You don't pass them, even if they're going kind of slow and you're in a hurry to get somewhere, you don't go around them. And I didn't see any troops stationed, you know, just out there at a checkpoint or something like that.
Well, Bagram is there. It's a tremendous base. Yeah. Were you at Bagram at all?
No, I was by it. I didn't go out actually to it.
It wasn't on your agenda?
That's, yeah.
None of the three of you, is that right? Were any of you there?
On a previous trip, we circled around the perimeter of Bagram and we stopped at the intersection that leads right into Bagram. In fact, the next day, a suicide bomber killed himself and no other people. At exactly the spot that we were at. The Bagram Theater of Internment Facility, which would be the prison that was just built, has apparently now been switched over to another area. And we do want to learn more. We do want to understand more about the people that are imprisoned, whether inside of Bagram or another new facility that's been constructed. These places are huge, they're sprawling, they're very well guarded, and but it is possible. I sat down with villagers from outside of Bagram who talked to us about how they felt, and it was quite negative, how they felt about being in an area that has this big, huge prison that's been plonked right in the middle of their area. What's your question?
That was my question.
That's it, okay.
Had you interacted with any U.S. troops?
No, I'm sorry, I had...
Did you seek any out to talk to them, how they felt about the war, so on and so forth?
Well, I actually was, again, on a previous trip, seeking them out all right, because I was completely lost, and I was trying to find the section of the airport where the United Nations helicopter was going to take off. I thought in about 5 minutes, and they wouldn't talk to me. I'm sure I must have looked like a chicken without my head, so I don't really blame them, but they didn't want to talk. But we do get chances to talk with the groups, well, they call themselves Iraq Veterans Against War, but they now include many Afghan Veterans Against War, and they've created a whereas statement that's quite compelling to me, and I think we should try as much as we can to interact with the returning troops.
Or while they're there, if it's conceivable to you that if somebody went there, Bagram, they could consciously interact with U.S. troops there, make out these troops, for example.
I don't know if the microphone is working. People aren't hearing you.
You can't hear me? Is it, hear me now?
He is suggesting that if there are visitors to these areas, mm-hmm. and you're talking about U.S. troop bases,
right.
would you try to...
interact with them, outreach to them?
It would be most difficult. I would think the soldiers themselves would have been warned not to speak with...
They have been? You know this to be sure.
With the peace mm-hmm. activists. Oh, okay. I think what I'm interested in, the people who live in the surrounding areas, the Afghan themselves, how do they feel about the base?
But my question is, do you think it's conceivable?
Yeah. I think it's conceivable. I know it. When I was in Iraq, for example, I was at a forward operating base, which is much smaller than anything like Bagram or some of these huge sprawling bases that you really can't get near on your own. If you go through the public affairs people with the military, depending on situations, you might be able to get access officially. But I went there unofficially and stayed with them for a few days. And I suppose if you really tried, that you could probably find a situation similar to that in Afghanistan, where you could. But it's not easy.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Joe Ergo. I'm a Vietnam vet and a member of Vets for Peace. My question is, well, each of the speakers did something very important, I think, for the audience tonight. Eric talked about the horror that the people are going through, which is really important that we hear that. Kathy also talked about the horror, but she did this map, which is very important for people to understand the strategic reasons why the U.S. is there. I mean, once I understood the strategic reasons for Vietnam, it helped to clarify what we were up against. You began, you get more serious about what you're up against when you understand what this map is saying. And Mike brought this whole question of the empire into the equation, that we don't just live in a country, we live in an empire. And it's an empire that it's in the very DNA of this whole system, going back to the wiping out of the Native American people, for 200 years, all the wars and invasions. So my question to each of the speakers is, what is it going to take to end this empire and get to a point where we can close every U.S. military base in the world, where we can remove all of the means by which the United States controls every country in the world, half the countries in the world? What is it going to take to do that? And I think the more that we base ourselves on this kind of reality, then the conversation in this room can be based on a real hope and not despair. That's my question.
I'll jump in there and I'll answer this very quickly, Joe. I think it's going to take the same thing to get the U.S. out of the business of empire as it's going to take for us to have health care for everybody in this country, to have policies that that will get us decent mass transportation and policies for jobs and education. And what that is going to take is getting the supposed democracy that we have in this country functioning to the extent that we can actually start governing ourselves and get out from underneath this corporate rule that we've got. Because this corporate rule and the lack of self-governance is at the root of so many problems that we have. And I think what's helpful about it, and I'm glad you put it that way, what's helpful about it is, to me, it points to the importance of joining with people who are working on these various other struggles and understanding what the commonality is and seeing how we can build a political movement that's going to result in us not just getting a little better health care or not just getting out of Afghanistan, but allow us to govern ourselves so we can quit doing this stuff in the first place.
And I think our first speaker that came to the microphone, I'm sorry, I forgot your name. Nancy Duplessis indicated, what about combining with the people who are concerned for climate? And on April 8th, in front of the White House in Washington, D.C., there will be a joint demonstration called for by the National Coalition for Nonviolent Resistance that's aiming to bring together people concerned about climate with the anti-war activists. And I think that, you don't have to look far in New York City to find groups that are working hard, working every single day to effect the kinds of changes that we need. But there's also a tendency to want to distract people, to, you know, dangle sports and entertainment constantly in front of adults and children and encourage adults to act like children in a sense. And so I think we have to try to resist that as well and really kind of set our priorities so that we're finding actions commensurate to the crimes being committed. And the risks we take are not going to be anything close to the risks our friends in Afghanistan have been taking, and certainly to risks that we've seen in other parts of the world and in the modern history we've experienced. What I mean is there's not going to be a death squad at your door. There's not going to be a massacre of your loved ones. There's not going to be torture of people who associate with you. We experience inconvenience. And I think none of us ever want to let inconvenience get in the way of acting in accord with our deepest desires. And so to acknowledge the depth of our desire to put war behind us, there couldn't be possibly a better vocation. But I think sometimes we almost get into clicativism, thinking, well, you know, if I just keep hitting the button on the computer keyboard, somehow that's going to replace the need to be on the phones and out on the streets and with activists and swelling the numbers of people who will do the organizing. And this is a great sign of it. I mean, I'm so grateful to Joan and the others. We're a good gathering here on a Friday night, and I think we also have companions who want to work on these issues, who are bearing the brunt of the warfare. There's a man named Ramadan Bashar Dost, and Mike and Eric and I met with him. He should be in the New York Times regularly. People should know his name as well as they know Karzai. He was the former Minister of Planning in Afghanistan. He resigned his post as an act of conscience. He came in third in the presidential elections. You know where we meet him? In a tent. It's his symbol. He won't meet people in an office. He meets people in a vacant lot after you go along a dusty, unpaved road. And he sits in a tent, and you sit on plastic chairs. He doesn't have a single bodyguard. He drives around Kabul in kind of a beat-up old jalopy. And people love him. You say his name, and it's disarming. People say, oh, yes, Bashar Dost. Well, we should know about him because he's putting forth a vision for a non-military solution. And he would like to see the warlords called into accountability through courts of law. So we who have such access to research about the international criminal courts, we who can help to bind with these groups that want to see non-military solutions, that's also part of our responsibility. To hear not the question, what does the United States want for Afghanistan, but to hear the question, what do people in Afghanistan want for their future? And I would wage a bet that very few of the average ordinary Afghans want to see their future dictated by their invaders and occupiers.
And one last sentence, I just want to say something because of that, what the previous speaker before me said. The United States organizes the prostitution outside every U.S. major military base in the world, from Seoul to Djibouti to Manila to every outside, the United States organizes it, and that's just another manifestation of the U.S. empire. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jessel Noor, and my question is, in the spirit of keeping alive the voices of Afghanistan, and bring those voices here into our discussions, into our lives, what would be the response of the Afghan youth that you spoke with to those like self-proclaimed liberals in the U.S. that argue against an immediate withdrawal, saying it's not politically feasible, or asking like what is the alternative? Like what would be next if the U.S. was to withdraw its troops tomorrow? I think that's an important discussion we have to have.
Jessel, thank you. That certainly is a question that's being asked, I think, in every encounter that we had in Afghanistan. I was impressed by a young woman who said that even though she realized that if the Taliban were to return, her current ability to move about in the center of Afghanistan and to study. That's as much freedom as she has, might be lost. But still, as she takes a look at the bigger picture, she does not want the U.S. troops to stay. Now, she's unusual in speaking up in that regard. Some of the Afghan youth peace volunteers said to me that they're not in the custom, in their tradition, of speaking when their elders are present. They're afraid to challenge their elders. And so I remember Faiz pulling me aside and saying, you know, sometimes when I hear of the things that the U.S. troops are doing, I wonder if they're not like the Taliban. So I think that the idea that were the Taliban to go out of the kind of more marginalized areas and actually seize power, that there would be a great change. Well, some people have pointed out that the abuses that are associated, the abuses of women under the Taliban, were happening before the Taliban ever existed. Now, that's not something that we want to then say, so therefore just let it go on. It's always been that way. We can't walk away, and we never should want to walk away from our responsibilities toward Afghanistan. But I think we shouldn't imagine that the peace movement would be calling for an end to United States involvement with Afghanistan. No, no, no. The United States will owe reparations to Afghanistan, not charity, reparations. We illegally and immorally invaded that country. We helped to create situations of civil war and tremendous suffering, and we owe billions of dollars. Alfred McCoy, a wonderful researcher, has said that it would cost, in order to restore the rural infrastructure of Afghanistan, $34 billion to replenish the flocks, to build the irrigation systems, to set up in the mountainsides the reseeding of the mulberry and pistachio and walnut trees. $34 billion, that's a huge amount of money. But that's what one supplemental spending bill was, just one, for one season, that was passed in addition to the bloated $708 billion that Americans are asked to pay for our capacity to maintain a huge killing machine. So it's not our job to prescribe how the troops would leave or even the exact timetable. Our job is to say that those troops never should have been there, that Afghanistan is not land that belongs to the United States, that at no point did Afghan people threaten the people in the United States. I was in a small village with young women who are very bright. They don't get to go out of their village. True, once a year the women can go out of the village to the shopping strip. But you know, I asked them, did you ever hear of a time when planes flew into a tall building in the United States in a city called New York? And I could tell as the translator was translating my question that they thought, she's kind of crazy. They never heard of 9/11. And I asked them, did you know that the United States, my country, has invaded your country? And they looked a little blankly. And then the mother clarified. She said, just we know that almost every 10 years, we have to grab our elderly people and our babies and run away and live in the mountains, even if it is snowing. So one invader, one occupier, maybe the languages change. But I don't think it would be the case that average ordinary Afghans feel that the United States is there in a capacity of protection. But they don't necessarily want to be invaded by a new group. I think that our job is to assert that, as Mike said so clearly, war is not the answer, and to help expand the space for non-military options.
I have a question that I would like to ask the panelists. Do you know about the Dear Afghanistan campaign? Can you talk about it?
Huh? I think he can write about it.
Well, the
it happened on January 1st, 2011.
Yes, yes. And it was organized in part by the two people that are sitting up here. I went there and observed it and wrote about it, but Kathy and Eric and some of the people in Voices for Creative Nonviolence really were the people who organized it, along with the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers. And so,
well, for those in the audience that don't know, about 2,300 people or several hundred people around the world participated in a telephone a marathon by way of email and Skip and Twitter and Facebook, and they're going to do it again on March 19th. So it would be an opportunity, and I think if you have your blog, you could give to people that it's possible to have that telephone conversation with Afghani people, because that's what it was. Mm-hmm. It's been very, very successful.
Yeah, please do consider getting familiar with the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers. You can type just those four words into Google and you'll get quite a variety of ways to be in touch with them. One is to watch their videos. They've produced many videos. They're kind of charming little vignettes. Another is to read their December review, and that's a really scholarly document, and the footnotes would put you in touch with the documentation of why it is that these youngsters felt that the December review that the Obama administration put forth was actually fraudulent. Another is to be in touch with the Nowhere to Turn report. 29 NGOs in Afghanistan signed on to a report challenging the International Security Assistance Forces and NATO and the United States government. Practice of night raids and death squads and assassinations and undercounting the numbers of civilians that have died and arming. This is a big problem, arming every single village, creating local militias. This is a prescription for civil war. You put arms in the hands of, you know, suddenly uniformed people that are the strong arms in these villages, and then were the United States to leave, there would be a much more heightened likelihood of civil war. Well, Petraeus wants this. There's so much evidence that General Petraeus doesn't want to even achieve a victory, that his idea of winning is perpetual warfare. And so on the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers website called Journey to Smile, or you could also go to the People's Journey, you'll find lots of documentation and lots of ideas about this. And then I also hope people will become familiar with Dr. Ramadan Bashar Dost, somebody whose contributions right now I think are very vital for Afghanistan.
Thank you. And we thank Kathy Kelly, we thank Eric Stoner, and we thank Mike Ferner. They have just recently returned from Afghanistan. And they have given us a most illuminating. Oh, I'm so sorry, I didn't see you. There are two other. Is it just two or just one? I didn't see you. Come. Yes, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Paula Rogovin. I teach in the neighborhood, and I'm a member of Military Families Speak Out. My son served twice in Iraq, and our organization is a group of 4,000 military families who are strongly opposed to the war in Iraq and in Afghanistan and want all the troops and the contractors home now. I want to thank you so much for what you did and what you've been doing, and you know, particularly teaching us what you've learned in Afghanistan. You urged us to continue our work, and I hear to step up our work toward ending both of the wars. And we noticed there are several people from our vigil in Teaneck, New Jersey, who are here tonight. And we noticed that a lot of the vigils around the country have kind of folded, have kind of ended, or there are one or two or three people at these vigils. So I'd like to urge everyone what you do is fuel our fire when you give us this information. I'd like to urge people, if you're not going to a vigil, go to a vigil. If there isn't one in your area, start one. If you used to go to one, go back to it. Write letters to community newspapers, to local newspapers, get involved. There's going to be there's a campaign by Military Families Speak Out to push this issue of the cost of war, to really bring it to people who are involved in fighting against the budget cuts in our schools, in our libraries, in our hospitals. And so we, you know, we've spent over $1 trillion on these two wars. And we want people to push that information, go to National Priorities Project and get that data and get it to people who are involved in these other struggles so that we can work together. And in Military Families Speak Out, we talk about the human cost of war to our troops. And you've added this other dimension of the cost of war to the people in the countries we've invaded. And it's what my question after all of that is, how can people reach you? How can people hear, get you to speak, or other people from your delegation to speak at our forums and our rallies and other events? Because it's wrong for us just to talk about the loss of our troops. It's wrong. We must always talk about the cost of war to the people in those countries we're invading. Thanks.
Well, I think for me, you could just, anybody could be in touch with me afterwards. I can give you my email and phone number, and we could be in touch. We're easy to get a hold of, generally.
Tomorrow I'm going to be in Long Island with the Muslim Peace Coalition, and many of the people that will be there are from New York, so I hope that you could also be in touch with Central and South Asian people in your communities. Pardis Kibrai, working at the Center for Constitutional Rights, is one person who's a fine advocate of the rights of people. She's an Iranian woman. And then you also have here in New York Bill Quigley. He's a superb activist and writer and pacifist and a legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. We always rely on the Catholic Worker, and Kathy Breen is here from that community, and some of the other Catholic Workers are here tonight in the audience. I see John, and that's a community that has been part of many delegations to war zones, and particularly with regard to Iraq in the case of Kathy Breen, but she's also been in Syria and in Jordan. And as Mike said, the situation is repeated again and again and again, the homelessness, the displacement, the bereavement, the loss. So education, education, education. You know, realtors say location, location, location. We have to say education. But education leading us to action. Take those vigils inside the office of your elected representative and say you won't be prepared to leave until you hear how it is that this representative would justify the cost of war. And then I think Veterans for Peace and the way that they've covered the backs of the Iraq veterans against war, the veterans who've come back from Afghanistan, their messages are always extremely vital to our peace work. Oh, yes, of course. Yeah, thank you. We have Mark Johnson also here from the Fellowship of Reconciliation. And Leila Zond was part of our delegation and so beloved. She was able, by language and by just her compassion and genuine care, to make wonderful connections with the people we met.
It seems to me that, the Republicans, I thought, were interested in war. And then President Obama came and everything just continued the way it is. So I was wondering, since you have so much, you know, so much information on how the civilians in Afghanistan are faring, perhaps you should have your voices taken right away to the White House. So before the State of the Union address, you know, Obama doesn't give the same old speech that he always does, but he'll hear a little about what you have to say. So I was wondering if you have any plans for that.
Well, actually, the day before I left to go to Afghanistan, I was one of 130 some people that got arrested at the White House for and I'm sure there must be some people here, anybody here who was there, whether you got arrested or went just to be supportive. All right, all right. So we do those kinds of things, and we can always do more of them, don't get me wrong, but I really want to stress the importance of organizing so that we can build the political strength that's going to take to really be able to govern ourselves so that we don't get into these problems in the first place. You know, it'd be great to not have to go chain yourself to the White House fence in order to speak out against a war and actually be able to figure out what we're going to do with our wealth in this country, something positive in the first place.
Greetings. My name is Bud Karatsa, citizen of this republic. My perspective is very different from yours, Ms. Kelly. I don't think the American people are just going to be inconvenienced, even a serious inconvenience. We are faced with a ruling class which will do everything it can to maintain its power. Already, we should not think that they will be softer with Americans than they are with the people in Somalia or Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine, or any other place where they have operated, for example, in South America. I don't know if many people know about it, but the American military command under the Obama administration has, I believe, set up a military command right here in the United States to deal with American citizens when they know that there is going to be a lot of disturbance from the American people as things get worse with this economy. We are all in danger. Anybody who dissents is in danger. You saw that 24 people were already subpoenaed. Another four younger people were subpoenaed. We see Corporal or Private Manning in that horrible type of mental torture that he is now living in without a sheet or pillowcase. We saw there were 131 citizens, veterans, who were arrested. How many people here can say that they saw this information in the public press? Nobody can say it. They are trying to suppress us, they will suppress us, and they will not be soft with us. And this is why I think that we face a very serious situation in the history of our country as it develops.
My name is Ken Dalton. I'm the president of Veterans for Peace, Chapter 21, New Jersey. Also, I'm hold it closer. Okay, I'm the president of Chapter 21, New Jersey, Veterans for Peace. I'm also the North Jersey coordinator for Vietnam Veterans Against the War. I'm a retired municipal firefighter from the city of Clifton, New Jersey, and probably one of the few, probably the only member of Veterans for Peace or Vietnam Veterans Against the War who participated in 9/11 rescue effort. And the reason why I bring that up is because a lot of times the right-wingers always say, well, what about 9/11 to justify this? What about 9/11? You know, while I was in 9/11, I was in the ground zero, and I got very sick about 3 months later with an upper respiratory infection, which took over a year to get rid of with various antibiotics and steroids. So, you know, I'm a veteran also of the Vietnam War and the War on Terror myself. But one thing I'd like to bring up is this war wouldn't be possible if they had to get the amount of soldiers up there. They would have to go back to conscription. And that would be as popular as, you know, it would never fly with any administration. They're all deathly afraid of it. They know that people would be taken to the streets, students. One of the reasons, something that they rely on to propagate these wars is something that was founded after World War II. To stop the expansion of, to check the expansion of the Soviet Union, which was NATO. NATO should have been abolished the day that the Berlin Wall came down. But instead, we have Republican and Democratic administrations which want to expand NATO into places like Georgia and the Ukraine and the former Soviet republics. And the point I'd like to bring up is that maybe, like, as a veterans organization dedicated for peace, Veterans for Peace, I know there's the Veterans for Peace in Australia. I don't know if there's like organizations in other NATO countries. But maybe we have to get to the militaries and to the people of the NATO countries and let them know that their kids are being used as cannon fodder for the U.S., for the United States Empire. And maybe, you know, it's another area that we should maybe be looking into, expanding into countries where also, like Germany has troops and losses up in Afghanistan, Canada, British, and maybe get more veterans from those countries to join in with us. Thank you.
I think we have heard those who had questions, and I again want to thank our presenters, Kathy Kelly, Eric Stoner, and Mike Ferner, who have just returned and have given us a really wonderfully eye-opening glimpse of what is going on there, but also what we can do. I'd like to mention right now, because I am a member of the Granny Peace Brigade, that our No Basis Committee is having on Sunday, February the 27th, at what time? At 1:30 at Symphony Space, a meeting, actually a showing of the film Standing Army. It's a documentary made by some Italian filmmakers, which talks, among other things, about the whole question of the empire and military bases. So again, we want to thank our panel.